Good to see you all this morning. Glad you're here. As we begin, Frank's going to lead us in prayer. Would you bow with us?
Our Father in heaven, we're grateful that you permitted us to come together again today to study your word and to worship you. We're thankful for our health and the many blessings that you bestowed upon us so richly. We pray that you would be with Brother Greer as he teaches the class. The things that he studied will be beneficial to us, that we might be better Christians as a result of being here. I ask you to bless all those that are not with us today, and pray that they're doing the things that are right on your side. In Jesus' name we pray.
Amen. We're working through Acts chapter 22 into 23 and kind of moving along. What we've been studying about is the missionary journeys of Paul. Paul's back in Jerusalem. It's been pretty eventful since he's got back there. He was only there for a few days. In fact, as we left off on Wednesday, in fact, he's going on from Jerusalem to Caesarea. Under guard, wasn't exactly his choice to be going there. At least not in that way. But it was interesting to think about the events that took place here in the last chapter or so in Jerusalem and how quickly some things took place. When he went back to be there in time for the day of Pentecost and arriving there, meeting with James and the elders of the church in Jerusalem and trying to figure out what he could do where maybe there wouldn't be a conflict. Well, seems like a conflict was inevitable. And even though the elders suggested that he go with four men who had taken a vow and go with them to be purified and, in fact, pay for their offering and things like that, so it would prove to the Jews that, in fact, he was not against the Jews and he was not against the law of Moses, though he is taught already that to be a Christian, to be a disciple of Christ, one does not follow the law of Moses, but we follow the law of Christ. But that doesn't take away the fact that he was a Jew and that there were many Jewish Christians. And so it was hoped that maybe that would make things a little bit better for him in Jerusalem, but it didn't work that way. And when he went to the Temple Mount, there was problems. And those accusations made against him, some of them just not true at all, that he had taken a Gentile into the temple, well, that wasn't right. It was an accusation that's unfounded and untrue. But we can remember now the mob that seemed that took place because of that. And that the Roman guard had to come basically and rescue him from his own people, from the Jewish people, and they took him to the barracks. And the commander there, trying to figure out what's going on and what should he do with Paul, determined to take him back down before the Sanhedrin, remember? You know, the leaders there among the Jews. And to let them ask him questions, try to understand what was going on. And remember, as we've looked and we've considered these pictures of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount, and we've tried to get in our mind a picture of the scene as it unfolds. We can about imagine Paul being led out of the barracks over here and being led across the Temple Mount and coming over here to the Stoa where the Sanhedrin met. But all didn't go just all so smooth there either. And there were conflicts. And the Sanhedrin stood up against him and they were divided. It was the Pharisees and it was the Sadducees. And I think in some way sort of end it all. You remember what Paul said? He said, I too am a Pharisee. And he confirmed his belief in the resurrection, which of course made the Sadducees not any too pleased. And so the Roman guards had to again come down and by force take Paul and take him back to the barracks. It's a pretty incredible scene when you think about all of that and how that's unfolding for us. And then there was this plot against Paul. You know, again, the commander decided he was going to take Paul down and try to sort this out. And let me back up on that. There was actually a plot to bring Paul down as if he was being taken to the Sanhedrin and the guards would have to bring him down. And there was a mob, 40 men, who had taken a vow that they would not eat until they had killed Paul. Remember? But word got back to the commander that this was the plan, and he made a new plan. And that's how Paul wound up going to Caesarea. And he took him by night to Caesarea. And that's kind of where we're getting back into our story in Acts chapter 23 and beginning at verse 23. Neil?
Before we get to that, something that came to mind reading through this. The Sadducees remind me a lot of the so-called religious leaders of today. It's convenience. It's operation, set of rules, but do not believe in the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
There's no spiritual aspect to it. There's no belief.
Mm-hmm.
There's no faith. We have so many people who so-called teachers of theology who have an analytical aspect or understanding of it, but have absolutely no spiritual understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that I feel is what the Sadducees were at that point.
You know, it's a very difficult philosophy to try to understand. If there's no resurrection, then there's just not a whole lot to look forward to. And yet that was the belief of the Pharisees, or of the Sadducees. Yeah, the Sadducees, of no resurrection. So now we see Paul and the preparation that's being made to take him to Caesarea. I mean, there's a whole contingent going to be going with him to ensure his safety. It's kind of interesting to me, the steps that were taken. In Acts chapter 23, let's read several verses here. Beginning at verse 23, and speaking of the commander, it says that he called for two centurions, saying, "Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night, and provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And he wrote a letter in the following manner: "Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. I then came with the troops and rescued him, having learned he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. And I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him worthy of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charge they brought against him. Farewell." And then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And the next day they left the horsemen to go with him and return to the barracks. When they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was born from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear you when your accusers have come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Kind of an interesting scene here as it's unfolding. I mean, here we have 470 soldiers that are being used to protect Paul. 470. Now, you can kind of see Paul in the middle of all of this, can't you? And the horsemen surrounding and the spearmen and the other soldiers. I take it that there's many of these who are walking along. And then you have the horsemen where Paul would be in the midst of all of them on horseback, probably chained to another soldier. And the command being given by the commander, deliver him to safety. And it seems to me that all has been done to try to ensure that. Remember the insurrection against Paul, there were 40 who had taken a vow, you know, to kill Paul. Were there others involved in that? Well, I don't know. But I kind of think they have numbers on their side as far as the soldiers go. And so they went part way. You recall, you know, when Paul was on his way to Jerusalem, they came down from Caesarea through Antipatris, and down to Jerusalem. Now they're going back that same road. Remember there was the old Roman road there? And some of the mileposts along the way where they're going right back that same road. And one of the centurions, I would presume, is carrying a letter with him from the commander. I just found some pictures. I thought that was kind of interesting. What did the letter look like? We write a letter and we get stationery and we write things out. Well, this was the stationery of the day. It was written out on papyrus or something like that, a wood type paper. Or it was rolled up on a roll and covered with linen to protect it or something like that. Or maybe it was just written on wood. But these are some letters sort of the day that have been found. It's not this letter, but just something to consider. And so Paul was, well, let me turn this around. The question or outline is, why? Why was Paul being sent to Felix? I mean, why is he being sent away from Jerusalem? Yeah, I know there's a mob there and he's wanting to be killed, but that's what the commander was for. He's tried to sort this out. It hasn't been too successful yet. So why is he being sent to Felix?
Like you said, he doesn't know what to do with the situation anymore. He's just...
Yeah, he's...
Send it on and let somebody else deal with it, maybe.
He's kind of like, he said, well, I haven't got to the bottom of this. You know, the situation, the tension here is escalating. If something happens to Paul, it's going to come back on me. And so, yeah, and so let's send him on to someone else. Neil?
He had already judged that Paul was innocent of death. No reason for him to be changed, period.
He's not seeing any proof.
But if he let him go, he knew there were 40 people who would kill him.
Couldn't let him go in Jerusalem.
So I can't let him go here.
Mm-hmm.
I need to have some reason to keep him.
Right.
So I want to send him up here, make it a little more difficult than chasing down. If it happens in Caesarea, well, that's their problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and he's sending him on to another authority.
Was Felix maybe the governor? Did he say he was the governor?
It is. So Felix is a man of authority. And in fact, you know, as governor, he had rule and reign over a fairly wide area. And at this point in time, Felix has been serving in this position for some time.
Yeah, the commander is a military commander. This is more of a political situation.
And
so it needs to kick upstairs to the political arm of the governor.
And so the commander is seeing now that like this, okay, this is out of my lane now. And someone else is going to have to deal with this.
This isn't directly with your question, but one of the things that occurs to me, you look at 470 soldiers, that seems a little bit overkill. But this commander had already messed up.
Mm-hmm.
He put Paul in chains,
mm-hmm.
a Roman citizen,
mm-hmm.
and he was fearful. And it seems to me that he's kind of overcorrecting
yeah.
for his mistake a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I would think that you know you didn't you know, even with 40. I don't think you would you know typically get Jewish people attacking Roman.
Probably. Yeah, it doesn't seem like it.
So I wonder if there's something going on, because it says he was fearful because he had done that.
Yes.
Back in chapter 22 there.
Well, and the idea that Paul is a Roman citizen, you know, is maybe sort of the trump card here, you know, because he knows that he's being charged by the Jews, but he can't make anything of the accusations, you know, that if there's anything of substance behind this. What he knows is, what he had come to know that he didn't know up front is that Paul's a Roman citizen and he has some rights and I have to protect those rights. It's getting hard to do that here. And so maybe that's part of the reason too for sending him on.
Interesting way that he words it. I found out he was a Roman demon. Kind of got that reversed.
Yeah. He wrote the letter in such a way to kind of make it sound as though he's done a really good job. I rescued him. You know, I went and I rescued him. Well, okay, well, there's sort of some truth to that.
But rescued Roman is the way he made it put it.
Yeah, you know, he was just trying to dispel the mob. You know, initially, the first time around, I came with troops and I rescued him having learned he was a Roman. Well, he didn't learn he was a Roman until after he had come and taken him and put him in chains and was about to have him beaten. That's when he found out he was a Roman. So, yeah, some of the words there are true, but not in the way he tells the story. It's kind of interesting, but maybe he's trying to save his own hide in this, as was said.
My New American Standard says they examined him by scourging. I thought that was kind of a strange word.
Yeah. And what verse was that in?
22, 24.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah, it's New King James says that, and said that he should be examined under scourging so that he might know why they shouted against him. And it was the idea that, you know, when he was taken back to the barracks that time, the commander is saying, all right, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Yeah.
You said they had stretched him out with thongs. I mean, they had gotten that far.
Yes, before Paul spoke up, you know. And so, I mean, this was getting serious here. And as we had said, we discussed before, you know, the whole purpose behind that was the Roman commander was saying, well, I mean, I can't get the truth out of these Jews down here, these Jewish leaders, you know, they're fighting amongst themselves, you know, and so I'm going to get to the bottom of this, you know. And so I think that was the idea of the examining by scourging.
What verse is the 400 soldiers?
Go in chapter 23, verse 23.
Where
there's 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen.
Oh, you're adding that all
together. That's 470. That's quite an entourage, isn't it? I mean, it's like, I don't think they like snuck out of town. You know, they're leaving at 9 o'clock at night, you know, but you can't hide, you know, a whole regiment or whatever that would turn out to be. Overpower. Overpower.
And so you want to put 40 people? Okay, I got 400.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I got you by 10 times. That's right. Interesting, you know, picture of all of this, you know, as it's coming about. So being sent to Felix. Felix is the governor. And in fact, we'll talk about Felix a little bit more as we go on. But Felix has been serving in this role probably 6 or 7 years. At this point. And so he's well known. You know, a lot of governors or precepts or whatever they could be called at different places, different times, you know, often they didn't serve very long. It was kind of a short duration run for many of them. Because if you kind of made someone higher up, somebody in Rome upset, you were taken out. Sometimes I really mean taken out. You know, you didn't last. So you had to work real hard, you know, to keep things quiet and keep things smooth and not to make somebody higher than you upset. And so some have said that serving, I mean, there are those who have served longer in some positions, but that in this role, that's sort of a long time. And Felix did so because he wielded a lot of power. He was pretty ruthless in the way he went about doing things. So some people were scared of him. He knew how to wield power. And that's where Paul's being sent.
Assignment like this sometimes be kind of a punishment to send them way away somewhere, way away far from Rome, you know, where maybe they wouldn't really want to go to. I don't know.
I wouldn't know how to answer that, really. You know, I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question. So he's on his way to Caesarea. Felix is the one who has authority to make a judgment. And as someone said, you know, Caesarea was perhaps a more neutral place than Jerusalem. Jerusalem was then, and is now, you know, kind of a hotbed. Things can escalate there quickly. Caesarea, maybe not quite so much. And so the letter was written, and it describes Paul's transfer to Felix and why he was being sent there. And so Paul is on his way to Caesarea. Now, I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about Caesarea. We talked about it some on our way going to Jerusalem. Well, there's some more things about Caesarea that are interesting. In fact, there's quite a bit of history about this city in the first century period of time. In fact, primarily it was a first century city. It was established a little before the first century. As we'd said before, it was Herod the Great who built this city between 22 and 10 BC. And so during that period of time, there was a lot of resources put into this city and a lot of things built. And so at that time in the first century, it was kind of a new city. Now there was a place there before. A naval station, a Phoenician naval station. It's not like it was not on the map, so to speak, but not on the map like it is now. Now, the city today, it looks like this. It lies in ruins, at least the old part of Caesarea. It's an Israeli national park that anyone can go and visit there. And the Phoenician naval station, Stratton's Tower, which is actually the remnants of it, you know, down here, some kind of a tower that helped guide the ships in, is kind of the impression that I have with that in the old harbor. But remember when we started looking at this before, we talked about the harbor that Herod had built, the harbor that's out here, and how he had underwater jetties put in place, you know, cement jetties underwater installed so that it was a safe harbor. And by the first century, it was a very busy harbor. It was a lot of commerce that was here and taking place. Herod had built the city in some ways to compete with Rome. Now, I don't mean that it was like Rome. Rome was an incredible city. But that it offered some of the same things that could be found and enjoyed in Rome. It was an incredible theater that would seat thousands. There was the Hippodrome here where there were all kinds of events to be held there. It's very large, like 1,300 or 1,400 feet long and 160 feet or something like that wide. You can see the chariot races, can't you? Can you see the dust rising up from there? And can you see Herod sitting in whatever, wherever his place would be, you know, cheering on? There were some other events that took place there that would have not been quite as glorious, you know, different kinds of gladiator fights and some things, you know, such as this. But this is quite a city. And looking far back up in here, you see that little line right there? You can hardly see it. That's a couple of miles away, I would presume. That's one of the aqueducts coming into town. It's quite a sight, quite a scene. And an aqueduct that ran for 8 miles from the Carmel Mountains. Mount Carmel is somewhere back there in that haze. You remember when we were coming through Tyre, you know, just a little while back, and we could see as we looked from the harbor, from the downtown section of Tyre, going looking south, we could see the Mount Carmel mountain range, remember? Well, now we're south of that, and we're looking back north to the Mount Carmel mountain range. You know, and so the mountain range is about halfway between Tyre and Caesarea. And one of the things most interesting to me is Herod's palace that was built here. And it's interesting because Paul is going to spend some time there. I mean, that's where he's going to spend about 2 years, in fact, at Herod's palace. Now, he's not living in the same place, in the same conditions that the king would be in. But he's there somewhere locked up at Herod's palace. We're not quite to that yet, but let's get this in our mind because that's where we're headed. And that's where we're going to be reading, you know, on to that point. So get your bearings set as we go on here a little bit farther with looking at some things in Caesarea. Here's the theater and the hippodrome. The harbor is down here. Here's the aqueduct. It's way down here, but it's bringing water right down in here to town. That was its purpose, is to bring water right down into town. And then Herod's palace. You got a view of how the lay of the land is there. Let's look at it this way. And we see the hippodrome, and here's the theater, and here's the palace, the remnants of it at least. You know, this had to be quite a place in its day. I mean, here it's a promontory palace, as some say. It juts out into the water, into the Mediterranean. And there's two very distinct sections of the palace. There's the upper and the lower palace. And here is a swimming pool that is just nearly Olympic size swimming pool. I mean, the Mediterranean Sea is not enough to swim in. And so, you know, he has this swimming pool that some have said was most likely a freshwater pool, because there were channels that are found that would have brought water from that aqueduct, you know, would have brought water into that pool. And I kind of get it and take it that that may have been open around the pool. I mean, the palace here was two-story, and there are colonnades that would come all the way around. And the living quarters was up over top of that pool. And so that's pretty nice digs. That was the good part of being king. I mean, if someone didn't come along and kill you, you had a good place to live, because other people would want to live in that same place too. Power does some peculiar things sometimes. And so let's go back. If we were standing right over here and looking this away, well, here's what you would see. This was kind of the view, looking across the pool out to the Mediterranean Sea. And that's where Herod would have stayed. And he lived there for some time. I don't think Paul's staying right there. I think Paul is staying close by. He is there at the palace, or he will be soon there at the palace, but not just right there. And so kind of taking another look, you know, down here is the pool in the lower part of the palace, and it was two-story, they say, the living quarters up above, and there's the bathhouse here, the mikvah for ceremonial cleansings that would take place, and there's this audience hall. I've wondered a little bit, when Paul's on trial, is that where it was at? I mean, it doesn't really say, we don't know, but it was there for something. This audience hall, is this where the king would have had his judgment seat and you know, had court? And Felix, when he was there, is this where that would have taken place? You know, Paul's going to be somewhere very soon in Caesarea standing before Felix. It might have been there. It could have been somewhere else in town too. I don't know. And then there's these administrative offices, is what some have said. They're kind of on the edge of the palace. They're not in the living quarters, but they're in the upper part up there where there's some office area. And so try to imagine if you were standing somewhere over in here, looking this away. It would look something like this, if you were looking across there. And here's those smaller office areas, or some have said this is some of the jail cells where some were kept. And what we know, as we'll be reading along here, you know, very soon, or we just, you know, read that, you know, he was sent to Caesarea. He came before Felix, and Felix said, okay, I'm going to hear his case. And he commanded Paul to be kept in Herod's praetorium, and that's palace. And so is this where Paul was kept, right in here? Well, we don't know for sure. Some feel pretty confident that this was it. This is the cells. This is where he was kept at. Oh, a little personal picture. Here's the old guy standing with three young Timothys a few years ago. They kind of let me hang out with him, and it made me feel good. Some young preachers that I think a lot about is Sean Jeffries and Andrew, I can't remember his name. I saw him last week. What's Andrew's last name? He was here for a meeting. Andrew Roberts. We sat next to each other for 2 days. And Adam Pogue. And three just young men that I enjoyed spending some time with. And so we went to jail together, maybe in Paul's jail cell. Well, the theater. The theater was built in the days of King Herod the Great. This is sort of the finished product. It's been added on to, it's been modified through the centuries, and it's what looks today, looks like today. And there's a very notable event that took place here that we've already read about, but maybe we just didn't quite catch that this is where it took place. If we go back to Acts chapter 12, you might look back there with me. Acts chapter 12. King Herod Agrippa the First, going back to, it was king like 37 through 44 AD. Now he was the grandson of Herod the Great, the one who built the city of Caesarea. So Agrippa the First, he went to Caesarea to visit there. And Herod was not a friend of the Lord's church. In chapter 12, we are reminded that he is the one, verse 2 says, he is the one who killed James, the brother of John, with a sword, James the Apostle. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded also to seize Peter. And it goes on to say that he intended to bring him before the people after the Passover. He was going to kill Peter too. But the Lord intervened in that. And the Lord sprung him from the jail cell and saved him. But the story with King Herod Agrippa I wasn't over at that point. A little bit later in the text, we find that Herod went down to Caesarea. Verse 19. Herod had searched for him and not found him, that is, looking for Peter. He examined the guards and commanded that they should be put to death. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there. So the Lord sprung Peter from the jail cell. The guards couldn't explain that. Herod had them killed because they had lost their prisoner. Verse 20. Now, Herod had been very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. But they came to him with one accord, having made Blastius, the king's chamberlain, their friend, and they asked for peace because their country was supplied with food by the king's country. On a set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat on his throne and gave an oration to them. Okay, start getting this in your mind. Now, Josephus would say that on the second day of this festival, that Herod appeared in the theater with a robe made of silver. Now, I don't know if that could be the audience hall at the palace. I tend to think it's the theater. The theater, remember, is not that far away, you know, from the palace. And there was a number that had come together. And so Herod goes over to the theater, and he has a robe made on that was made of silver. I'm not sure exactly what all that means, like silver, or just some kind of silver material with little things on it. I don't know, but it sparkled, he said. He said that it sparkled like the sun. The people cried out flatteries to him, you know, because he looked incredible. I mean, you know, and they flattered the king. And he had given some oration, he'd given some speech, as Luke tells us in chapter 12, and the people just, you know, went on and on. They declared him to be a god. And he ate that up. He thought a lot of that. He was carried away with all of that. In the process of that, it is said that he saw an owl sitting over on a rope. Well, that was not a good sign. That was a bad omen. An owl sitting on over here was the omen of death. And he saw that. And immediately he was struck with severe stomach pains. Verse 23 says, the people kept shouting, "The voice of a god and not of man." And immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give glory to God. And he was eaten by worms and died. It didn't happen quite that fast. Josephus goes on to say that he was struck with severe stomach pains and that he was carried over to his house, over to the palace, and he died 5 days later. Very painful death. Happened right there. Caesarea, the theater. It is where this took place. It was there in that palace where he died. And these were the events that we're surrounding that. Just interesting to get those pictures in our mind, isn't it? And then there's the Hippodrome. We mentioned already it was huge, 165 feet by 1,300 feet. Some have said 1,500 feet. I don't know. It's big, whatever it would be. And it was built in such a way to compare with some facilities in Rome. Caesarea is not going to become Rome, but it's sort of the Rome of Palestine, so to speak. And there are going to be some things available there as far as the theater goes and the hippodrome that compare to some events that would take place in Rome. In 10 BC, when the city was sort of the grand opening was taking place of the city, there was a competitive sports festival that took place that was kind of on a parallel with the Olympics. And so you imagine the hundreds, the thousands of people that have come to Caesarea, and perhaps the hundreds of competitors in this Olympic-style type sports event that's taken place. And there were dramas that took place there. There were shows that took place. There were the chariot races that took place. And one time at least, and probably more than one time, there were real-life dramas and confrontations that took place between the Roman and the Jewish leaders. So it is written that in 26 AD, now we're in, Herod the Great is no more. Now in 26 AD, this is during the life of Christ, during that same period of time, a familiar character is in Caesarea, Pontius Pilate. He's going to come into the Bible story a whole lot more so in 33 AD. But in 26 AD, he was here. And he had ordered, he was the prefect over this whole region in Judea. And he had ordered that statues of the emperor from Rome be taken to Jerusalem and placed all around town so everyone would know who they should bow down before. That didn't go well in Jerusalem. And the Jews stood up against that, saying, no, we cannot bow down before the emperor. I'm a little surprised that there were some who stood up that way, because the children of Israel always had a problem with bowing down before idols and false gods. I'm not sure why they stood up now in the way they did, in a very bold way, but they did. And there was a number of them that went to Caesarea to protest. And it was here in the hippodrome, where Pontius Pilate was in his seat, was in his bench, or whatever it would have been. And these protesters came and wanted these statues, removed from Jerusalem. And Pilate had them surrounded by soldiers, three men deep, and basically said, oh yeah, what are you going to do about it? And they all laid out on the ground and they extended their necks and they said, we would rather die than bow before the emperor. And Pilate backed down. And he says, all right, I'll remove those statues. Interesting story, isn't it? Secular history tells us about that. And so just saying, there are some pretty interesting things that happened in this city of Caesarea in the first century. It was a powerful and very important city of that time. We mentioned the aqueduct. So the aqueduct was built by the Romans to bring water into the city, because Caesarea is right by the Mediterranean Sea. You would think that a water supply would not be a problem. No, I know you can't drink from the Mediterranean Sea. That's salt water. But you'd think, being in such close proximity to water, you could dig a well somewhere. But there was not a good water supply in the city of Caesarea. And so there was an aqueduct that was built. Actually, there were three sources of water brought in. But this is the most prominent one that stands out in a very interesting way. I mean, we've seen some other aqueducts at other cities that we have traveled through in the missionary journeys. And we looked at a couple. And in one city where there was a long tunnel, 3,000-foot tunnel, I believe it was, cut through the mountain to bring water. But here's an 8-mile-long aqueduct. We could see it in that first picture way out there, remember? And it went all the way to the mountains, the Mount Carmel mountain range. And it was, for the first 4 miles of it, there was just a channel that was cut through the rock of the mountains. But as it got beyond the mountains then, of course, the above ground aqueduct had to be built. You know what's amazing to me is just the engineering of the time. You know, that the grade was just enough to bring and deliver the water to town. It wasn't so great that water would go so fast and all slosh out before it got there. But the grade was just right, so there was a flow of water that traveled 8 miles and was delivered to the city of Caesarea. It's an interesting sight to see. There's actually three sources of water. You have this aqueduct. It's the high aqueduct. A few hundred yards to the east, there's a lower aqueduct that comes into the city. And then from the south, there's actually a piped water supply that came into the city. And that's how the city had its water back in the first century, and even for a long period of time after that. And thinking back to Herod's palace and that fresh water pool, Olympic-sized pool, I presume it was one of these aqueducts that brought water in to Herod's palace and filled that pool. And so that's Caesarea. And I wanted just to spend a few minutes getting in our minds what that place looked like, because Paul has been delivered there. And we even know where he's staying there at Herod's palace, perhaps in one of those rooms that we saw. And he's going to be there for 2 years. He's going to be there. And he's going to have some freedom, we will see. He will be able to have friends who come and go and can visit with him and, I presume, care for his needs. It kind of took some of the burden off the prison system if you allowed friends and family to bring clothes and food and such, you know, to the prisoners. I don't have the impression that Paul was eating what the king was eating, even though they were in close proximity. Paul was still in jail. Even though he would have liberties, he was still locked up, and he was in jail. But now, who would you think would be the ones that would come and minister to Paul? He's not from there. You know, that's not his people in that way. Who do you think took care of him when he was there?
Christians.
You remember when Paul came through town? You know, before, it wasn't that long ago. You know, it was, in fact, it was only a couple of weeks ago when Paul actually, you know, time-wise, came through there. And he spent a little bit of time in Caesarea. Who did he spend time with?
Philip.
With Philip, who had four daughters who prophesied, and some of the other Christians who came and gathered. What was their departing like? They prayed together, you know, and they bowed together and prayed. And there's some other notables in town. Can you think of somebody else who's a Christian in Caesarea? Acts chapter 10 and 11.
Cornelius,
the centurion, and his household. So there's some Christians in town. And I would presume that they would have been the ones. And there's others that come to visit him. But those are the ones, I would think, were the ones who were helping to care for Paul. All right. Wow. Time is done. Lesson number 18. You didn't pick it up already. It's in the back. That's where we're starting out Wednesday night, Lord willing. We're going right into chapter 24. Chapter 24 is where we'll be going. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your comments.